This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At our top stories this hour, Iran rejects as unconstructive and uncalculated a statement by three European countries expressing doubt over Tehran's commitment to sanction removal talks. Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine's army has recaptured some 2,000 kilometers of territory in September, adding the Russian army is doing the right thing in fleeing the counteroffensive. And the lighting of public buildings stops in the northern French city of Lille in a bid to reduce energy consumption as winter approaches and prices soar. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran has rejected as unconstructive a statement by three European countries censuring Tehran's stance and the JCPOA revival talks. Foreign Ministry spokesman says it's a regret that France, Britain, and Germany have issued such an uncalculated statement as talks to revive the 2015 accord are still ongoing. Nasser Kanani warned the three European countries against walking in the footsteps of Israel, which is trying to derail the JCPOA revival talks. He says the European countries should accept responsibility for the consequences if they continue on this path. Three European countries said in their statement they have quote-unquote serious doubts over Iran's sincerity in seeking a nuclear agreement. They warned that Tehran's position jeopardizes prospects of restoring the 2015 accord. We have talked to political commentator Syed Mustafa Khoshchishm about the reason why the JCPOA revival talks have not been fruitful so far. Take a listen.
All throughout the past 10 months or 11 months, Iran has been the only party that has been offering initiatives. And the only time that the Western parties offered a new initiative was the last in the Vienna talks. But still, they tried to reserve some concessions, some very important points for Iran that are called Iranian red lines, a closure of the IAEA cases and removal of three, four ambiguous words that seem to be something subtle, something small, but they are not. They are a world. I mean, they are trying to trap Iran, actually. They are trying to just receive some energy supplies probably for a few months and then ruin the accord again. So they are playing fool, actually, with Iran. And since Iran has stressed that it has been very much constructive in the talks all throughout the past several months, it expects the Europeans and Americans, especially the Europeans that are facing very cold winter, they need Iranian crude, of course not gas, but the Iranian crude that could be much helpful to their economies and could save lives in Europe. But they still insist on pressuring Iran empty-handed.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has seized a foreign vessel carrying some 757,000 liters of diesel out of the country. An IRGC official said the vessel aimed to smuggle the fuel to other countries. The official added seven members of the unnamed vessel, who were all foreign nationals, have been handed over to legal authorities. The fight against smuggling is the priorities of IRGC's naval forces. Since March, more than 1.5 million liters of diesel has been seized by IRGC's navy. Almost 7 months into the war, Ukrainian forces are carrying out counteroffensives, taking back control of several areas from Russian troops. Ukrainian special forces say their units are now in the town of Kupiansk in the east. The advance has potentially trapped thousands of Russian troops. Ukrainian forces have also isolated Russians in the city of Izium and the Kharkiv area. Meanwhile, Kiev claims its forces have cut supply routes on the west bank of the Dnipro River. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky says the army has managed to recapture some 2,000 kilometers in September, adding that the Russian army is doing the right thing in fleeing the counteroffensive. Moscow has acknowledged Ukraine's advances. The Russian military says the withdrawal of its troops is aimed at regrouping and building up efforts in the Donetsk direction, that is. Charles III has been formally proclaimed king by the UK's Accession Council, a ceremonial body that confirms the new monarch.
I am deeply aware of this great inheritance and of the duties and heavy responsibilities of sovereignty, which have now passed to me. In taking up these responsibilities, I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands and of the Commonwealth realms and territories throughout the world.
Charles succeeds his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, who died on Thursday at the age of 96 after more than seven decades of rule. The televised ceremony was held at St. James Palace, where the Accession Council assembles upon the death of a monarch to make a formal proclamation of the successor to the throne. Former prime ministers and other top officials attended the ceremony. A state funeral is to be held for the late queen in just over a week. Our correspondent in London, Robert Carter, joined us a short while ago to tell us more about why or what the royal family will be facing in the future.
Well, I think the royal family has had a massive blow time and again to its reputation in recent years specifically because apart from Queen Elizabeth II herself, she was known for being able to, you know, maintain composure, maintain an aura of credibility, maintain respect of her institution that she represented. She was considered a very popular and well-rounded head of state, essentially by her supporters at the very least. However, her family members, not so much. In fact, many of them have been embroiled in all sorts of scandals related to racism scandals. There was, of course, her disgraced son, Prince Andrew, who, of course, was embroiled with the international grooming gang scandal linked to Jeffrey Epstein. These were, of course, deeply damaging to the royal household's reputation.
Social media users are asking for Queen Elizabeth II to be remembered as the UK's last head of state. Hashtag abolish the monarchy is trending on various social media platforms. People think that the royal family is a political institution which lives off people's taxes and doesn't make any contributions to the society. Meanwhile, calls are growing in former UK colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed doubt about what role a monarch is supposed to play in today's time. Activists also argue that Charles's accession is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery reparations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Queen Elizabeth II, the UK's longest-serving monarch, died at the age of 96 on Thursday after reigning for 70 years. Aside from expressions of grief, the monarch's death revived criticism of her legacy, a legacy of colonialism and oppression. Upon the Queen's death, her eldest son and heir to the throne, Prince Charles, became king amidst all the public relations headaches and scandals that has gripped him, including infidelity in his ex-marriage, financial corruption, racism, and political interference. Many on Twitter remembered the Queen as a symbol of the British colonial empire, which worked through the decades to enrich itself through violence, theft, and oppression of other nations. Some also listed a number of criminal wrongdoings of Britain under the rule of the late Queen as a response to one of tweets you will find here. It's written, "Here are some of the crimes committed by the UK during the 70-year rule of Queen Elizabeth II. So, for example, in 2003, chemical attack against Iraq by British forces. More recently in, for example, 2011, role in Syria crisis. And even more recently in 2015, support for Saudi Arabia's crimes in Yemen." Mirka replied to this tweet by saying, "UK's monarch signs off on legislation. Some of those matters would have crossed her desk. UK's involvement is with NATO, and they're both equally responsible for harm to various parts of the world. Current UK involvement in war against Russia is also deeply abhorrent." Another reply by Ina Badar reads that this list is incomplete. I'll add two FYI. One, expelling Mauritius natives from Diego Garcia Island and giving it to the U.S. Army. And two, U.K. destabilizing actions in Somalia. Another reply by Kalaivan Dunn reads, 2009, UK helped to Sri Lankan genocide on Tamils, which killed 0.15 million people. The monarchy came under fire on Twitter by nationals of other countries from all over the world besides the British, which the UK subjected to or still subjects to colonialism and imperialism. You know, the list is so long that we're honestly unable to name all of them in this edition. So let's take a look at some tweets, our final batch. Lord Abraham Mutai said, let's be honest, Britain violently colonized Africa. They brutally murdered our ancestors. They brutalized our mothers and fathers. That is the true legacy of Queen Elizabeth as far as Africa is concerned. That we are hanging on to the Commonwealth years later is a travesty. Davande has our next tweet. England killed 9 million Iranians, half of the population, 100 years ago, and destroyed a large part of Iran. He's referring to the World War I years. Elizabeth, in her 77 years of rule, not only did not apologize and compensate, but also continued the crimes of England against our country. Subham Sahu has our next tweet. In nearly 200 years of genocidal colonialism, the British Empire stole $45 trillion in wealth from India, 17 times more than UK GDP, killing millions. The UK monarchy, Queen Elizabeth, the royal family are simply symbols of murder, exploitation, and theft. Michel Maliketo Melanga has our final tweet. What sort of a queen commits crimes against humanity and gets away with it? She did this not only in Africa and the Caribbeans, but India, Yemen, and Pakistan as part of her duties. Are we going to be silent about that? And that's a wrap for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Authorities in the French city of Lille have stopped lighting in public buildings to reduce energy consumption. This as Europe is suffering from soaring energy prices ahead of winter. We have discussed Europe's energy crunch in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Civic officials in the northern French city of Lille have stopped lighting of public buildings to reduce energy consumption as Europe grapples with soaring energy prices ahead of winter. The measure is part of a package that also includes lowering temperature in most public buildings and poles, as well as closing the city's tropical gardens and two fountains. The whole package is expected to cut the city's energy use by 7%, saving 1 million euros in energy costs. France, like other European nations, faces a hike in fuel prices due to reduced gas supply from Russia following the war in Ukraine. In Britain, the largest energy supplier, Centrica, is planning to voluntarily cap profits in an effort to cut household costs. That after, the new premier, Liz Truss, vowed to cap soaring energy bills for 2 years in order to protect consumers and businesses. Fred Weir is a journalist and political commentator who joins us from Moscow. We also have Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, reflecting on what the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has said about trying to cut off Russia's gas supplies, in particular to Europe, he said that's just an impossibility. Europe is grappling and facing a shortage of energy, in particular gas, of mammoth proportions. At what point do you think they'll realize how deep they're in this in order to see whether they should be treating the Russian factor a different way?
I don't know. It is a bad situation. It's a crisis of monumental proportions. And it is an outcome of the total economic warfare that's going on. I mean, Russia is accused, rightly, of weaponizing energy, but just about every other economic factor has been weaponized against Russia already, from financial to technology to even like mundane consumer goods imports. So Russia has been careful about this, but step by step, they are making the point to Europe that Russian energy that just isn't a thing to be taken for granted. if you're throwing everything but the kitchen sink at Russia. So this is a problem, and I honestly don't know how bad it is for Europe there. It is clear that an economic model existed, like, say, 15 years ago at its peak, in which Russia sold energy and other raw materials to Europe and bought back most of its consumer goods, most of its life-level imports from Europe. Europe was far and away Russia's biggest trading partner. And it's clear now that Europe, especially Germany, built their economic prosperity on cheap Russian energy.
Well, that's the whole thing, Marcus Papadopoulos, isn't it? The mere fact, the last sentence there that Fred Weir said, we're going to find out what's going to happen. That's what the societies in different European countries are facing, the unknown, including the governments, I'm assuming, because we're not seeing a real clear-cut plan. We saw what happened in Prague last week, 70,000 people showed up. So the reasons for social unrest to occur are pretty high. Now, are the European governments really facing up to the music, as they say?
I would like to very quickly comment on the current military situation in Ukraine. Now that the Russian army is in Ukraine, the Kremlin and the Russian people as a whole are resolute in their determination to see the Russian army victorious. And the Russian people will consent to, for example, 1 million Russian losses if that means that the Russian army either capture all of Ukraine or most of Ukraine. That is the traditional Russian mindset in war. Now, turning to the energy crisis plaguing Europe, it is abundantly clear that the European Union elites care nothing for the welfare of the ordinary European man and woman. The European Union elites are loyal only to the United States government and the various tentacles of the United States' empire, which includes, of course, repugnant organizations such as the World Economic Forum. The European Union leadership is not loyal to the ordinary European man and woman. No, the European Union leadership is loyal to those whom it serves, to those whom have given it its wealth and its status.
Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. That's Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator there from Moscow. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you. Historian, political analyst, and author. We appreciate your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It was quite clear from day one that the Zionist regime military would not practice justice for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh on May 11th of this year. What comes to mind is that how many times the fabricated regime of Israel has ever practiced justice, and how can you expect from an apartheid regime who brazenly steals land and kills innocent people to practice justice? These are the questions that need to be answered by the Zionist regime's allies and aides, the U.S. in particular. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the second part. The website of Common Dreams, penned by Juan Cole, author, wrote, "The Israeli military issued a brazen whitewash of its killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghla and its shooting of her colleague, Al Jazeera producer Aliya Samoudi, on May 11th of this year. Using whistle words, the report admitted that it was likely that an Israeli sniper shot her dead. Since extensive video and eyewitness evidence proves that there was no militants in the area at the time of her killing, CNN had already concluded after an extensive investigation that the Israeli military killed Shirin in a targeted attack. Shirin's colleague, Shatha Hanaisha, told CNN, "We stood in front of the Israeli military vehicles for about 5 to 10 minutes before we made moves to ensure they saw us. And this was a habit of ours as journalists. We move as a group and we stand in front of them so they know we are journalists. Then we start moving." Video taken at the scene and reviewed by CNN showed there was no gunfire and there were no clashes that could have provoked the Israeli sniper. The journalists were in full view of the Israeli military and had waved at the soldiers and drawn attention to their press jackets. The Israeli sniper fired in a targeted way and over again, suddenly and without provocation. The sniper could have been under orders to take out the Al Jazeera journalists who were covering an Israeli army raid on Palestinian territory, a raid that may have been anticipated to involve Israeli actions that the army was unwilling to see documented. That is just as killing civilians through reckless disregard for their lives and killing even though the shooter should have known the risk to civilian life are war crimes. So the killing of a journalist such as Abu Aghla under similar conditions is a war crime. Since the Israeli regime has now admitted the high likelihood that its sniper killed Shirin, surely it will now treat the killing as a form of manslaughter. At the very least, and punish the sniper? No, it won't. But surely it will pay reparations to Shirin's family? No, it won't. Surely the Biden administration will intervene to ensure justice is done for the American citizen like Shirin? No, it won't. The whole affair signals once again Washington's commitment to awarding the Israeli impunity for such killings, even of American Christians. The website of Al Jazeera English also wrote, "Israel says it will not launch a criminal investigation into the killing of Al Jazeera journalist who was shot in the head. Multiple detailed investigations, including by the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority, and several media outlets, including CNN and the Associated Press News Agency, found that Abu Aghla was definitively shot by Israeli fire and that there were no Palestinian fighters at the scene when she was killed. The journalists who were standing next to her and witnessed the killing also said no Palestinians were present. Palestinian eyewitnesses told Al Jazeera's The Take podcast that they were never contacted by Israel as part of the investigation. In a statement recently, Abu Aghla's family said Israel tried to obscure the truth and avoid responsibility for killing Shirin Abu Aghla. As expected, Israel has refused to take responsibility for murdering Shirin. Her family is not surprised by this outcome, since it's obvious to anyone the Israeli war criminals cannot investigate their own crimes, the statement read. According to Al Jazeera, in a statement following the Zionist regime's announcement, the U.S. State Department again stressed the need for accountability, describing Abu Aqila as a fearless reporter who had earned the respect of audiences around the world. We welcome Israel's review of this tragic incident and again underscore the importance of accountability in this case, such as policies and procedures to prevent similar incidents from occurring in the future, the statement said. Al Jazeera has condemned the Israeli occupation forces' attempt to evade responsibility for Abu Aghla's killing. Al Jazeera Media Network denounces the findings of this investigation and stresses that this elusive admission is nothing but an attempt from the IOF to evade the criminal responsibility for the killing of Shirin, which has been proven by numerous independent and international investigations, the Qatar-based TV network said in a statement recently.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. And how about starting the day by pondering on an aphorism from Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The best kind of almsgiving is to help the weak.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect the opinions of others. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of respecting the opinions of others when performing the call for goodness and forbidding evil in the Islamic lifestyle. The fifth condition of calling for good and forbidding evil is that we must respect the opinions of the others. When someone is trying to call people towards the good and forbid them from evil, he must pay attention towards the importance of the opinions of the others, and he must respect their opinions. And therefore, when he is performing this obligation, he must bring his own reasoning and must listen to them. Sometimes what happens is the things that we know as evil or a sin, the others might think them as something which is normal, which is good to perform. And this is something which is normalized in the society. It is something that people are regularly performing. For example, in Islam, when we talk about the marriage and we say that the relation between the girl and boy must be according to the marriage contract, on the other hand, we see that in the West, there is a society, obviously the Western society, they have this relation of boyfriend and girlfriend, which they think as something legal. Now, we need to provide reason for that. Obviously, a boy and a girl cannot have relation with each other as a boyfriend and girlfriend, just meeting each other and start living with each other, talking to each other. But in an Islamic way, that they must have a contract marriage, or they must marry each other, either the temporary or the permanent. So we need to bring reasons for that, and we must respect what they say. But on the other hand, if we want to call these people towards the goodness, to explain that if you want to reach to the perfection, it is necessary that you must marry each other. And this is the way, this is the right way, which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has basically said for us. Therefore, they will come towards us. And this is one of the conditions that we must respect their opinion and bring our own arguments for them. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of respect of the opinions of the others in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said that sometimes when we want to call people towards the goodness and stopping them from performing or forbidding them from performing evil, we must pay attention to the opinions which others have. And then we must bring a proper reasoning, a proper proof with a light manner, with a nice talk, with a nice manner, in a nice place, and with the wisdom. We must bring all these things for them to tell them that what you're performing is not which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the creator of this universe, wanted. It is something which is been made by mankind. And we gave the example of marriage and like the relation of boyfriend and girlfriend. In the Quran, we have a verse in chapter Nahl, which is chapter 16, verse 125. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, "Udu'u ila sabili rabbika," call them towards the path of your Lord, "bil hikmati," with the wisdom, "wal maw'idhatil hasana," and a good admonition, a good advice, "wajadilhum," and have dialogue with them, "billati hi ahsan," with the manner which is the best, with the nice manner, have a dialogue with them and tell them what is the right and what is the wrong. And if they're not accepting, because, for example, they're non-Muslims and they're not accepting, it's upon them. But we need to have a dialogue in a nice mood, in a nice place, with a nice manner, and with the wisdom, with the proofs, with the logical proofs and intellectual proofs, so that they accept your wordings. And this is one of the conditions. This is the fifth condition of calling people towards good and forbidding them from evil, that we must respect the others' opinions. And according to that, we must bring the right proofs in a nice manner, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A2Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodiles seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations. A wide range of cutting-edge digital technology is grabbing the limelight at the 2022 China International Fair for Trade in Services, which is underway in Beijing. The exhibition is featuring a wide range of products, including artificial intelligence, virtual reality, metaverse, and 5G. Visitors can be seen taking virtual reality driving lessons and enjoying scenarios, including different road and weather conditions, wearing VR kits. It's the leading and largest comprehensive fair for trade and services in China. This year, an increasing number of traditional service companies are speeding up their transformations, resorting to smart technologies. The event has set up 9 thematic exhibitions, including cultural and tourism services, education and sports services, hygiene and health services, engineering, consulting, and environmental services. Foam is fun to play with, particularly for kids, but when it's mixed with art, it also becomes a grown-up matter. And that's what a German artist has done, creating a sea of rainbow-colored foam as an interactive art piece and allowing the audience to enjoy themselves and become part of the art. Colors mixed were by Stephanie Luning were turned into rainbow-hued foam cascading down the stairs. The performance was called Island of Foam, version 18. Excited children jumped in as soon as the bubbly sea reached the base of the stairs, delighted to be playing in the rainbow playground. The art piece is made up of largely of water and a food coloring. The artist says she loves working in public spaces and reaching a broad audience of all ages.
Because I like to be surprised by the result myself, and I like to work with this that you never know how it's going to turn out. You have the wind, the weather conditions, the locations, the audience. You never know how the people are going to respond and how the artwork turns out. And that's really what I like a lot, and also how to reach a broad audience.
However, Stephanie says there's tons of work behind all the fun, and cleaning up the mess can be hard. Interactive art is a form of art that achieves this purpose by involving the audience. The immersive art piece is part of the Greenwich and Docklands International Festival, an annual festival of performing arts and outdoor theatre.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Tehran Saray Gallery takes part in a massive art exhibition in South Korea, bringing Iran's leading and emerging artist to the Asian market. Works from six Iranian painters are displayed at the event, where hundreds of galleries account for more than $50 million in sales annually. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Seoul's annual global art exhibition has been reinvigorated this year with additional events and a most certain boost in attendance. The Korea International Art Fair continues an evolution that began with its launch back in 2002. This year features 164 galleries and more international exhibitors than ever before. That growing cosmopolitan experience and this region's growth as an art market hub is what brought a premier Iranian gallery to Seoul.
When we started this gallery, we had the big goal to just introduce Middle Eastern artists and Iranian artists to all over the world. So when you want to introduce artists, you cannot forget South Korea and Far East as well.
Sarai had participated in last year's art fair with paintings purchased by local Korean collectors. Expanding on that success at the event and as Iranian artists are growing in international stature, Hassan Saradipour decided to display works from six Iranian artists at this year's event.
Our gallery focuses on the established and emerging artists. This artist, Abbas Nasashamlu, he just wants to show that how the nature and how the human can affect to each other, how this experience he can bring it on the canvas, on the paper.
The massive exhibition featured paintings, although there were various multimedia and sculpture installations. As South Korean living standards have risen, more people have time and money to spend on such events. Their taste in art has also become more sophisticated.
South Korea used to lack art galleries compared to other countries. There was a serious lack of love for this level of culture. However, now these events, I think, create opportunities for more people to gain such appreciation.
For the first time this year, Freeze Art Fair in Seoul exhibited works from 110 galleries, including Picasso, other 20th century masters, and contemporary talents. Frank Smith, Seoul.
An Iranian movie wins the grand prize for the best film in this year's Moscow International Film Festival. In its international debut, No Prior Appointment won the Best Film and the Best Actress awards. The movie is a product of Farabi Cinema Foundation and directed by Behruz Shoaibi in Iran in 2021. It is the story of a girl named Yasaman who returns to Iran from Germany after her father's death. A short stay in her father's hometown and meeting those who know him leads her to a new understanding of humans and the concept of death. The 44th edition of the Moscow International Film Festival was held this year from September 4 to 11. Animals, no matter pets or wild, are more vulnerable to drowning or dying in resulting floods and mudslides. A veterinarian school in Pakistan is offering free treatment for animals injured in the recent devastating floods. The veterinary surgery department of Sindh Agriculture University has set up a makeshift animal hospital as flooding hit humans and animals alike in the surrounding area. Volunteers have been providing anything from surgery to medicine and even ultrasounds to the animals free of cost. People from flood-affected areas can be seen bringing their farm animals such as goats, donkeys, buffaloes, and cows into the center. The worst floods in history have killed an estimated 800,000 farm animals. But there were many heartwarming videos trolling on social media showing people come to rescue animals being stuck hopelessly.
Iran is famous for its hand-knotted carpets and ancient art which have been loved for centuries and are never going out of style despite changing tastes and increased competition from Asia. Striking geometric shapes that recall 20th century abstract art are what we expect to see in handmade Iranian rugs. But weavers and exporters have been forced to redesign a tradition dating back more than 2,000 years due to numerous problems. Carpet exporter Ahad Azimzadeh says, however, that a revolution is underway. Iranian rugs are known for dense, curving floral designs in rich colors. They were put on display in a recent exhibition that featured a rug with small squares of hypnotic diagonal blue and white lines and another depicting diamond and other patterns in gold silk. Some countries have overtaken Iran in the global market, but many say modern carpets will never replace the traditional ones, which are deep-rooted in Iranian culture. These days, computer technology is impacting every aspect of our life, providing a greater ability to place things, events, and people within context. An Iraqi museum has started using the technology and virtual reality headsets to make exhibits interactive and to bring scenes back to life. Visitors can explore heritage sites destroyed by terrorist groups. Now using thousands of photographs, a group of local engineers have given a virtual rebirth to five historic sites in Mosul and a broader Nineveh province that includes a mosque and its leaning minaret. But this museum brings sites back to life for the people who live in Mosul. Although large parts of the old city remain oceans of debris, authorities are trying to restore historic sites, mosques and churches in Mosul. A private museum along the Tigris River, which opened in mid-June, saw more than 4,000 visitors in its first month. The floating cinema of unknown waters is back in the Italian city of Venice and spectators are getting buoyant to reach the annual Open Sea Film Festival. On board a rowing boat, a motorboat, gondolas and whatever capable of floating, spectators sail to the shallows behind the Giudecca Island for this one-of-a-kind cinematic experience. The audience can watch the program from their own boat or a barge with chairs for those without floating transportation. The event consists of a series of screenings, performances and presentations on a floating platform and is held for 12 nights in the Venetian Lagoon.
A new bird species has been discovered on the southernmost islands of the Americas. Biologists are baffled.
Discovering new bird species is very, very difficult and rare because the world has been more focused on observing birds. Therefore, this means the discovery site is unique in the sub-Antarctic zone, on which Chile has important sovereignty. This raises the importance of caring for the environment and unique ecosystems, as these sites will allow us to carry out research on climate change, new species and behaviors.
The tiny bird weighs only 16 grams and has a large beak with black and yellow streaks along its body. Researchers say the animal is a subcategory of a species typically found in the Patagonia forest and inhabits tree trunks, but the newly discovered cousin has surprised scientists as it learned to burrow and live in a harsh tundra climate with bitter temperatures. The Diego Ramirez archipelago, where the bird was found, is an isolated bit of land. It also lacks mammalian predators and woody plants. Biologists and researchers from Chilean universities and various academic centers studied the birds for 6 years before announcing the new species.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Soleimani high-speed craft military catamaran, symbol of innovation in shipbuilding technology. The importance of a powerful and efficient navy for the Islamic Republic of Iran is undeniable, given that Iran has a very long sea borders, both in the south and in the north, and given Iran's geostrategic position in the Persian Gulf. In view of the fact that Iran has been subjected to an arms embargo for the past several decades, it is no surprise that Iran's shipbuilding industry, maritime industries and self-sufficiency initiative of the IRGC naval forces are all geared towards producing military vessels and submarines capable of satisfying the needs of the Iranian Navy and bolstering Iran's naval capabilities. Please stay with us for more details of the Shahid Soleimani high-speed craft military catamaran. The IRGC naval forces, which was established in the middle of the 8-year imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, gradually managed to build modern ships and modern submarines and military hardware for the IRGC Navy, using the most up-to-date and cutting-edge technology in the world. These logistical and military vessels have all been equipped with home-developed Iranian military hardware and weapon systems, which are able to compete on a global level. The RGC naval forces have traditionally relied on a variety of speedboats fitted with torpedoes, mines, machine guns, rockets and missiles, depending on the task that they tried to accomplish, or the mission that was set for them. These speedboats have helped the RGC Navy to secure Iran's southern waters in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman. But in more recent years, a fundamental change in innovation has occurred in Iran's shipbuilding industry, with a variety of catamarans being manufactured for the first time by Iran's maritime industries and IRGC naval forces. But what is a catamaran? A catamaran is a multi-hulled watercraft featuring two parallel hulls of equal size. It is a geometry-stabilized craft deriving its stability from its wide beam, rather than from a ballasted keel, as with a monohull, an ordinary boat. Catamarans typically have less hull volume, smaller displacement, and shallower draft than monohulls of comparable length. The two hulls combined also often have a smaller hydrodynamic resistance than comparable monohulls, requiring less propulsive power from either sails or engines. The catamaran's wider stance on the water can reduce both heeling and wave-induced motion as compared with a monohull and can give reduced wakes. Catamarans range in size from small sailing or rowing vessels to large naval ships. The structure connecting a catamaran's two hulls ranges from a simple frame strung with webbing to support the crew to a bridging superstructure incorporating extensive cabin and cargo space. The Shahid Soleimani high-speed craft military catamaran is an INCAT lightweight catamaran measuring 67 meters in length and weighing about 600 tons. The Shahid Soleimani catamaran is well-suited to performing naval tasks under difficult and inhospitable ocean conditions. This vessel is highly maneuverable at sea and is capable of performing small-radius circular movement in water. The maneuverability of this naval vessel sets it apart from other Navy vessels of similar size and makes it a perfect choice as part of a naval flotilla for the Iranian Navy. The Shahid Soleimani catamaran is equipped with four powerful Iranian-built engines, which gives it the capability of conducting long-distance naval missions without the need for any support from ports along the way. The range of this military catamaran is 5,000 nautical miles and gives the IRGC Navy the option of a military presence in any ocean or any sea throughout the world. The vessel also has the capability to carry a full-size military helicopter and can operate in turbulent waters and rough seas and oceans throughout the world. It is also well-suited to carry out reconnaissance and identification missions, since the INCAT catamaran is fitted with the latest radar, sonar, laser and telecommunications technology. It is capable of destroying targets both above and below the surface of water. It is also equipped with 20 and 30 mm artillery guns and is capable of launching missiles vertically with a range exceeding 150 kilometers. The Shahid Soleimani INCAT lightweight catamaran is also the only vessel in the Iranian Navy capable of launching both short-range and medium-range surface-to-surface missiles. The catamaran is also fitted with software which has been produced by Iranian specialists to guide its variety.